Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of A Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess, narrated by Tom Hollander. This book is copyrighted 1962 and 1986 by Anthony Burgess. In Anthony Burgess's nightmare vision of the future, where the criminals take over after dark, the story is told by Alex, a vicious 15-year-old droog, who recounts, through his brutal invented slang, a frightening fable about good and evil, and the meaning of human freedom. In the 1986 edition of this novel, author Anthony Burgess wrote the following introduction, titled A Clockwork Orange Resucked. I first published the novella A Clockwork Orange in 1962, which ought to be far enough in the past for it to be erased from the world's literary memory. It refuses to be erased, however. And for this, the film version of the book made by Stanley Kubrick may be held chiefly responsible. I should myself be glad to disown it for various reasons, but this isn't permitted. I receive mail from students who try to write theses about it, or requests from Japanese dramaturges to turn it into a sort of no-play. It seems likely to survive while other works of mine that I value more bite the dust. This isn't an unusual experience for an artist. Rachmaninoff used to groan because he was known mainly for a prelude in C-sharp minor which he wrote as a boy, while the works of his maturity never got into the programmes. Kids cut their pianistic teeth on a minuet in G, which Beethoven composed only so that he could detest it. I have to go on living with A Clockwork Orange, and this means I have a sort of authorial duty to it. I have a very special duty to it in the United States, and I'd better now explain what this duty is. Let me put the situation boldly. A Clockwork Orange has never been published entire in America. The book I wrote is divided into three sections of seven chapters each. Take out your pocket calculator and you'll find that these add up to a total of 21 chapters. 21 is the symbol of human maturity, or used to be, since at 21 you got the vote and assumed adult responsibility. Whatever its symbology, the number 21 was the number I started out with. Novelists of my stamp are interested in what is called arithmology, meaning that number has to mean something in human terms when they handle it. The number of chapters is never entirely arbitrary. Just as a musical composer starts off with a vague image of bulk and duration, so a novelist begins with an image of length, and this image is expressed in the number of sections and the number of chapters into which the work will be disposed. Those 21 chapters were important to me. But they weren't important to my New York publisher. The book he brought out had only 20 chapters. He insisted on cutting out the 21st. I could, of course, have demurred at this and taken my book elsewhere. But it was considered that he was being charitable in accepting the work at all, and that all other New York or Boston publishers would kick out the manuscript on its dog ear. I needed money back in 1961, even the pittance I was being offered as an advance, and if the condition of the book's acceptance was also its truncation, well, so be it. So there's a profound difference between A Clockwork Orange, as Great Britain knows it, and the somewhat slimmer volume that bears the same name in the United States of America. Let's go further. The rest of the world was sold the book out of Great Britain, and so most versions, certainly the French, Italian, Spanish, Catalan, Russian, Hebrew, Romanian and German translations, have the original 21 chapters. Now, when Stanley Kubrick made his film, though he made it in England, he followed the American version. And so it seemed to his audiences outside America, ended the story somewhat prematurely. Audiences didn't exactly clamour for their money back, but they wondered why Kubrick left out the denouement. People wrote to me about this. Indeed, much of my later life has been expended on Xeroxing statements of intention and the frustration of intention, while both Kubrick and my New York publisher coolly bask in the rewards of their misdemeanour. Life is, of course, terrible. What happens in that 21st chapter? You now have the chance to find out. Briefly, my young thuggish protagonist grows up. He grows bored with violence and recognizes that human energy is better expended on creation than destruction. Senseless violence is a prerogative of youth, which has much energy but little talent for the constructive. Its dynamism has to find an outlet in smashing telephone kiosks, derailing trains, stealing cars and smashing them, and, of course, in the much more satisfactory activity of destroying human beings. There comes a time, however, when violence is seen as juvenile and boring. It's the repartee of the stupid and ignorant. My young hoodlum comes to the revelation of the need to get something done in life. To marry, to beget children, to keep the orange of the world turning in the rookers of bog or hands of God, and perhaps even create something. Music, say. After all, Mozart and Mendelssohn were composing deathless music in their teens or nadsats, and all my hero was doing was raz-rezzing and giving the old in-out. It's with a kind of shame that this growing youth looks back on his devastating past. He wants a different kind of future. There's no hint of this change of intention in the 20th chapter. The boy is conditioned and deconditioned, and he foresees with glee a resumption of the operation of free and violent will. "I was cured, all right," he says. And so the American book ends. So the film ends, too. The 21st chapter gives the novel the quality of genuine fiction. An art founded on the principle that human beings change. There is, in fact, not much point in writing a novel unless you can show the possibility of moral transformation or an increase in wisdom operating in your chief character or characters. Even trashy bestsellers show people changing. When a fictional work fails to show change, when it merely indicates that human character is set, stony, unregenerable, then you're out of the field of the novel and into that of the fable or the allegory. The American or Kubrickian orange is a fable. The British or world one is a novel. But my New York publisher believed that my 21st chapter was a sellout. It was very, very British, don't you know. It was bland, and it showed a Pelagian unwillingness to accept that a human being could be a model of unregenerable evil. The Americans, he said in effect, were tougher than the British and could face up to reality. Soon they would be facing up to it in Vietnam. My book was Kennedyan and accepted the notion of moral progress. What was really wanted was a Nixonian book with no shred of optimism in it. Let's have evil prancing on the page and up to the very last line sneering in the face of all the inherited beliefs, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and Holy Roller, about people being able to make themselves better. Such a book would be sensational. And so it is. But I don't think it's a fair picture of human life. I don't think so because, by definition, a human being is endowed with free will. He can use this to choose between good and evil. If he can only perform good or only perform evil, then he's a clockwork orange, meaning that he has the appearance of an organism lovely with colour and juice, but is in fact only a clockwork toy to be wound up by God or the devil, or, since this is increasingly replacing both, the almighty state. It's as inhuman to be totally good as it is to be totally evil. The important thing is moral choice. Evil has to exist along with good in order that moral choice may operate. Life is sustained by the grinding opposition of moral entities. This is what the television news is all about. Unfortunately, there's so much original sin in us all that we find evil rather attractive. To devastate is easier and more spectacular than to create. We like to have the pants scared off us by visions of cosmic destruction. To sit down in a dull room and compose the Missa Solemnis or the Anatomy of Melancholy doesn't make headlines or news flashes. Unfortunately, my little squib of a book was found attractive to many because it was as odorous as a crate full of bad eggs with the miasma of original sin. It seems priggish or Pollyannish to deny that my intention in writing the work was to titillate the nastier propensities of my readers. My own healthy inheritance of original sin comes out in the book, and I enjoyed raping and ripping by proxy. It's the novelist's innate cowardice that makes him depute to imaginary personalities the sins that he's too cautious to commit for himself. But the book does also have a moral lesson, and it's the weary traditional one of the fundamental importance of moral choice. It's because this lesson sticks out like a sore thumb that I tend to disparage A Clockwork Orange as a work too didactic to be artistic. It's not the novelist's job to preach. It's his duty to show. I have shown enough, though the curtain of an invented lingo gets in the way. Another aspect of my cowardice. Nadsat, a Russified version of English, was meant to muffle the raw response we expect from pornography. It turns the book into a linguistic adventure. People preferred the film because they are scared, rightly, of language. I don't think I have to remind readers what the title means. Clockwork Oranges don't exist, except in the speech of old Londoners. The image was a bizarre one, always used for a bizarre thing. He's as queer as a clockwork orange meant he was queer to the limit of queerness. It didn't primarily denote homosexuality, though a queer before restrictive legislation came in was the term used for a member of the inverted fraternity. Europeans who translated the title as Arancha a Orologeria, or Orange Mécanique, couldn't understand its Cockney resonance, and they assumed that it meant a hand grenade, a cheaper kind of explosive pineapple. I mean it to stand for the application of a mechanistic morality to a living organism oozing with juice and sweetness. Readers of the 21st chapter must decide for themselves whether it enhances the book they presumably know or is really a discardable limb. I meant the book to end in this way, but my aesthetic judgment may have been faulty. Writers are rarely their own best critics, nor are critics. Quod scripsi scripsi, said Pontius Pilate when he made Jesus Christ the King of the Jews. What I have written, I have written. We can destroy what we have written, but we cannot unwrite it. I leave what I wrote with what Dr. Johnson called frigid indifference to the judgment of that 0.00000001 of the American population which cares about such things. Eat this sweetish segment or spit it out. You are free. And now, A Clockwork Orange.
Part 1. 1. What's it going to be then, eh? There was me, that is Alex, and my three droogs, that is Pete, Georgie, and Dim, Dim being really Dim. And we sat in the Corova milk bar making up our Razadox what to do with the evening. A flip, dark, chill winter bastard, though dry. The Corova milk bar was a milk plus mesto, and you may, oh my brothers, have forgotten what these mestos were like, things changing so scorry these days, and everybody very quick to forget, newspapers not being read much neither. Well, what they sold there was milk plus something else. They had no license for selling liquor, but there was no law yet against prodding some of the new veskies which they used to put into the old Maloko, so you could peat it with Velocet or Synthmesk or Drencrom or one or two other veskies, which would give you a nice quiet horror show 15 minutes admiring Bog and all his holy angels and saints in your left shoe with lights bursting all over your mosque. Or you could peat milk with knives in it, as we used to say, and this would sharpen you up and make you ready for a bit of dirty 20-1. And that was what we were peating this evening I'm starting off the story with. Our pockets were full of deng, so there was no real need from the point of view of crasting any more pretty Polly to toll-chock some old vec in an alley and viddy him swim in his blood while we counted the takings and divided by four, nor to do the ultraviolet on some shivering, starry, grey-haired petitzer in a shop and go smacking off with the till's guts, but, as they say, money isn't everything. The four of us were dressed in the height of fashion, which in those days was a pair of black, very tight tights with the old jelly mould, as we called it, fitting on the crutch underneath the tights, this being to protect and also a sort of design you could viddy clear enough in a certain light, so that I had one in the shape of a spider, Pete had a rooker, a hand that is, Georgie had a very fancy one of a flower, and poor old Dim had a very hound and horny one of a clown's litso face, that is, Dim not ever having much of an idea of things and being, beyond all shadow of a doubting Thomas, the dimmest of we four. Then we wore waisty jackets without lapels, but with these very big built-up shoulders, plechos we called them, which were a kind of a mockery of having real shoulders like that. Then, my brothers, we had these off-white cravats which looked like whipped-up kartoffel or spud with a sort of design made on it with a fork. We wore our hair not too long, and we had flip horror show boots for kicking. What's it gonna be then, eh? There were three Dvotchkas sitting at the counter all together, but there were four of us Malchiks, and it was usually like one for all and all for one. These sharps were dressed in the height of fashion too, with purple and green and orange wigs on their gullivers, each one not costing less than 3 or 4 weeks of those sharps' wages, I should reckon, and make-up to match, rainbows round the glazies, that is, and the rot painted very wide. Then they had long black very straight dresses, and on the groody part of them they had little badges of like silver with different Malchiks' names on them, Joe and Mike and such like. These were supposed to be the names of different Malchiks they'd spatted with before they were 14. They kept looking our way, and I nearly felt like saying the three of us, out of the corner of my rot that is, should go off for a bit of pole and leave poor old Dim behind, because it would be just a matter of cuppeting Dim a demi-litre of white, but this time with a dollop of synth mesk in it, but that wouldn't really have been playing like the game. Dim was very, very ugly and like his name, but he was a horror show filthy fighter and very handy with the boot. What's it gonna be then, eh? The Chelovek sitting next to me, there being this long, big, plushy seat that ran round three walls, was well away with his glazies glazed and sort of burbling slovos like Aristotle wishy-washy works outing cyclamen get forficulate smartish. He was in the land all right, well away, in orbit, and I knew what it was like, having tried it like everyone else had done, but at this time I'd got to thinking it was a cowardly sort of a vesh, oh my brothers. You'd lay there after you'd drunk the old Maloko, and then you got the mess all that everything all round you was sort of in the past. You could viddy it all right, all of it, very clear. Tables, the stereo, the lights, the sharps and the Malchiks. But it was like some vesh that used to be there, but was not there, not no more. And you were sort of hypnotised by your boot or shoe or a fingernail, as it might be, and at the same time you were sort of picked up by the old scruff and shook like it might be a cat. You got shook and shook till there was nothing left. You lost your name and your body and yourself, and you just didn't care. And you waited till your boot or your fingernail got yellow, then yellower and yellower all the time. Then the light started cracking like atomics, and the boot or fingernail, or as it might be a bit of dirt on your trouser bottom, turned into a big, big, big misto, bigger than the whole world, and you were just going to get introduced to old Bog or God when it was all over. You came back to here, and now, whimpering, sort of, with your rot all squaring up for a boo-hoo-hoo. Now, that's very nice, but very cowardly. You were not put on this earth just to get in touch with God. That sort of thing could sap all the strength and the goodness out of a Chelovek. What's it going to be then, eh? The stereo was on, and you got the idea that the singer's galosh was moving from one part of the bar to another, flying up to the ceiling and then swooping down again and whizzing from wall to wall. It was Bertie Lasky rasping a real starry oldie called You Blister My Paint. One of the three petitzas at the counter, the one with the green wig, kept pushing her belly out and pulling it in time to what they called the music. I could feel the knives in the old maloko starting to prick, and now I was ready for a bit of 20-1. So I yelped, ow, 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 like a doggy. And then I cracked this vec who was sitting next to me and well away and burbling a horror show crack on the oko or ear hole, but he didn't feel it and went on with his telephonic hardware and when the far-far-culool gets a rub-a-dub-dub, he'd feel it all right when he came to out of the land. "Wear out," said Georgie. "Oh, just to keep walking," I said, "and vidy what turns up, oh my little brothers." So we scattered out into the big winter notchy and walked down Margarita Boulevard and then turned into Boothby Avenue, and there we found what we were pretty well looking for, a Malenki jest to start off the evening with. There was a doddery, starry, schoolmaster-type vec, glasses on and his rot open to the cold notchy air. He had books under his arm and a crappy umbrella, and was coming round the corner from the public biblio, which not many ludies used those days. He never really saw many of the older bourgeois type out after nightfall those days, what with the shortage of police and wee fine young Mal Chickiwicks about. And this prof-type Chelovek was the only one walking in the whole of the street. So we goolied up to him, very polite, and I said, "Pardon me, brother." He looked a malinky bit poogly when he vidded the four of us like that, coming up so quiet and polite and smiling, but he said, "Yes, what is it?" in a very loud teacher-type galosh, as if he was trying to show us he wasn't poogly. I said, "I see you have books under your arm, brother. It is indeed a rare pleasure these days to come across somebody that still reads, brother." "Oh," he said, all shaky, "is it? Oh, I see." And he kept looking from one to the other of we four, finding himself now like in the middle of a very smiling and polite square. "Yes," I said, "it would interest me greatly, brother, if you would kindly allow me to see what books those are that you have under your arm. I like nothing better in this world than a good clean book, brother." "Clean," he said. "Clean, eh?" And then Pete squatted these three books from him and handed them round real scorry. Being three, we all had one each to vidy at, except for Dim. The one I had was called Elementary Crystallography. So I opened it up and said, "Excellent, really first class," keeping turning the pages. Then I said in a very shocked type galosh, "But what is this here? What is this filthy slovo? I blush to look at this word. You disappoint me, brother. You do really." "But," he tried, but, "now," said Georgie, "here is what I should call real dirt. There's one slovo beginning with an F and another with a C." He had a book called The Miracle of the Snowflake. "Oh," said poor old Dim, smotting over Pete's shoulder and going too far like he always did. "It says here what he done to her, and there's a picture and all. Why," he said, "you're nothing but a filthy-minded old skite bird." "An old man of your age, brother," I said, and I started to rip up the book I'd got, and the others did the same with the ones they had, Dim and Pete doing a tug of war with the rhombohedral system. The Starry Prof type began to creech. But those are not mine. Those are the property of the municipality. This is sheer wantonness and vandal work, or some such slovos. And he tried to sort of wrest the books back off of us, which was like pathetic. You deserve to be taught a lesson, brother, I said. That you do. This crystal book I had was very tough bound and hard to razz-rez to bits, being real starry and made in the days when things were made to last, like. But I managed to rip the pages up and chuck them in handfuls of like snowflakes, though big, all over this creeching old vet. And then the others did the same with theirs. Old Dim just dancing about like the clown he was. There you are, said Pete. There's the mackerel of the cornflake for you, you dirty reader of filth and nastiness. You naughty old vec, you, I said. And then we began to filly about with him. Pete held his rookers and Georgie sort of hooked his rot wide open for him and Dim yanked out his false zubies, upper and lower. He threw these down on the pavement and then I treated them to the old boot crush. Though they were hard bastards, like, being made of some new horror show plastic stuff. The old vec began to make sort of chumbling shooms. Whoop, whoop, whoop. So Georgie let go of holding his goobers apart and just let him have one in the toothless rot with his ringy fist. And that made the old vec start moaning a lot then. Then out comes the blood, my brothers. Real beautiful. So all we did was to pull his outer platties off, stripping him down to his vest and long underpants. Very starry. Dim smacked his head off near, and Pete kicks him lovely in his pot, and we let him go. He went sort of staggering off, it not having been too hard of a toll chock, really, going, oh, 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 not knowing where or what was what, really. And we had a snigger at him. And then, rifled through his pockets, Dim dancing round with his crappy umbrella meanwhile, but there wasn't much in them. There were a few starry letters, some of them dating right back to 1960, with my dearest, dearest in them and all that chapuka, and a keyring and a starry leaky pen. Old Dim gave up his umbrella dance and, of course, had to start reading one of the letters out loud, like to show the empty street he could read. My darling one, he recited in this very high-type gloss, I shall be thinking of you while you are away and hope you will remember to wrap up warm when you go out at night. Then he let out a very shoomy smeck. Ha, ha, ha! Pretending to start wiping his yarmer with it. All right, I said. Let it go, oh my brothers. In the trousers of this starry vec, there was only a malenki bit of cutter, money that is, not more than 3 gollies, so we gave all his messy little coin the scatter treatment, it being hen-corned to the amount of pretty Polly we had on us already. Then we smashed the umbrella and razz-rezzed his platties and gave them to the blowing winds, my brothers, and then we'd finished with the starry teacher type vec. We hadn't done much, I know, but that was only like the start of the evening, and I make no happy polylogies to thee or thine for that. The knives in the milk plus were stabbing away nice and horror show now. The next thing was to do the Sammy act, which was one way to unload some of our cutter so we'd have more of an incentive like for some shop crasting, as well as it being a way of buying an alibi in advance. So we went into the Duke of New York on Amis Avenue, and sure enough, in the snug, there were 3 or 4 old babushkas peating their blackened suds on the SA, state aid. Now, we were the very good Malchicks, smiling good evensong to one and all, though these wrinkled old lighters started to get all shook, their veiny old rookers all trembling round their glasses and making the suds spill on the table. Leave us be, lads, said one of them, her face all mappy with being 1,000 years old. We're only poor old women. But we just made with the zoobies, flash, 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 sat down, rang the bell and waited for the boy to come. When he came, all nervous and rubbing his rookers on his grazzy apron, we ordered us four veterans, a veteran being rum and cherry brandy mixed, which was popular just then, some liking a dash of lime in it, that being the Canadian variation. Then I said to the boy, give these poor old babushkas over there a nourishing something, large Scotchman all round, and something to take away. And I poured my pocket of deng all over the table, and the other three did likewise, oh my brothers. So double fire goals were brought in for the scared starry lighters, and they knew not what to do or say. One of them got out, thanks, lads, but you could see that they thought there was something dirty-like coming. Anyway, they were each given a bottle of Yank General, cognac that is, to take away, and I gave money for them to be delivered each a dozen of blackened suds that following morning, they to leave their stinking old Sheena's addresses at the counter. Then, with the cutter that was left over, we did purchase, my brothers, all the meat pies, pretzels, cheese snacks, crisps and chalk bars in that mezzo, and those too were for the old sharps. Then we said, back in a minuta, and the old petitsers were still saying, thanks, lads, and God bless you, boys, and we were going out without one sense of cutter in our carmans. Makes you feel real dobby, that does, said Pete. You could vidy that poor Dim the Dim didn't quite pony all that, but he said nothing for fear of being called gloopy and a domeless wonder boy. Well, we went off now round the corner to Attlee Avenue, and there was this sweets and cancers shop still open. We'd left them alone near 3 months now, and the whole district had been very quiet on the whole, so the armed militants or Ros patrols weren't round there much, being more north of the river these days. We put our maskies on. New jobs these were. Real horror show. Wonderfully done, really. They were like faces of historical personalities. They gave you the name when you bought, and I had Disraeli, Pete had Elvis Presley, Georgie had Henry VIII, and poor old Dim had a poet vec called P.B. Shelley. They were a real light disguise, hair and all, and they were some very special plastic vesh, so you could roll up when you'd done with it and hide it in your boot. Then three of us went in, Pete keeping chasseau without. Not that there was anything to worry about out there. As soon as we launched on the shop, we went for Slouse, who ran it, a big port wine jelly of a vec who vidded at once what was coming and made straight for the inside where the telephone was and perhaps his well-oiled pushka, complete with six dirty rounds. Dim was round that counter, scorry as a bird, sending packets of snouty flying and cracking over a big cutout, showing a sharp with all her zoobies going flash at the customers and her grudies near hanging out to advertise some new brand of cancers. What you could vidy then was a sort of a big ball rolling into the inside of the shop behind the curtain, this being old Dim and Slouse sort of locked in a death struggle. Then you could slushy panting and snoring and kicking behind the curtain and veshies falling over and swearing and then glass going smash, smash, smash. Mother Slouse, the wife, was sort of froze behind the counter. We could tell she would creech murder given one chance, so I was round that counter very scorry and had a hold of her, and a horror show big lump she was too, all nuking of scent and with flip-flop big bobbing grudies on her. I'd got my rooker round her rot to stop her belting out death and destruction to the four winds of heaven, but this lady doggy gave me a large foul big bite on it, and it was me that did the creeching. And then she opened up beautiful with a flip yell for the militants. Well, then she had to be toll-chocked proper with one of the weights for the scales, and then a fair tap with a crowbar they had for opening cases, and that brought the red out like an old friend. So we had her down on the floor, and a rip of her platties for fun, and a gentle bit of the boot to stop her moaning, and videying her lying there with her grudies on show, I wondered should I or not. But that was for later on in the evening. Then we cleaned the till, and there was flip horror show takings that notchy, and we had a few packs of the very best top cancers apiece, and then off we went, my brothers.
A real big, heavy, great bastard he was, Dim kept saying.
I didn't like the look of Dim. He looked dirty and untidy, like a vec who'd been in a fight, which he had been, of course, but you should never look as though you have been. His cravat was like someone had trampled on it. His maskie had been pulled off, and he had floor dirt on his litzo. So we got him in an alleyway and tidied him up a malenky bit, soaking our tashtooks in spit to chase the dirt off. The things we did for old Dim. We were back in the Duke of New York, very scorry, and I reckon by my watch we hadn't been more than 10 minutes away. The starry old babushkas were still there on the blackened suds and the Scotchman we'd bought them, and we said, "Hello there, girlies, what's it going to be?" They started on the old, "Very kind lads, God bless you boys," and so we rang the collar coll and brought a different waiter in this time, and we ordered beers with rum in, being sore athirst, my brothers, and whatever the old petitsas wanted. Then I said to the old babushkas, "We haven't been out of here, have we? Been here all the time, haven't we?" They all caught on real scurry and said, "That's right, lads. Not been out of our sight, you haven't. God bless you, boys." Drinking. Not that it mattered much, really. About half an hour went by before there was any sign of life among the Millicents. And then it was only two very young Rosses that came in, very pink under their big coppers schlemmies. One said, "You lot know anything about the happenings at Slouse's shop this night?" "Us?" I said, innocent. "Why? What happened?" "Stealing and roughing. Two hospitalisations. Where have you lot been this evening?" "I don't go for that nasty tone," I said. "I don't care much for these nasty insinuations. A very suspicious nature all this betokeneth, my little brothers." "They've been in here all night, lads," the old sharp started to creech out. "God bless them, there's no better lot of boys living for kindness and generosity. Been here all the time, they have. Not seen them move, we haven't." "We're only asking," said the other young Millicent. "We've got our job to do like anyone else." But they gave us the nasty warning look before they went out. As they were going out, we handed them a bit of lip music. But myself, I couldn't help a bit of disappointment at things as they were in those days. Nothing to fight against, really. Everything as easy as kiss my sherries. Still, the night was still very young. 2. When we got outside of the Duke of New York, we vidded, by the main bar's long-lighted window, a burbling old pianitza, or drunkie, howling away at the filthy songs of his fathers and going blurp blurp in between as it might be a filthy old orchestra in his stinking rotten guts. One vesh I could never stand was that. I could never stand to see a mooge all filthy and rolling and burping and drunk, whatever his age might be, but more especially when he was real starry like this one was. He was sort of flattened to the wall, and his platties were a disgrace, all creased and untidy and covered in cowl and mud and filth and stuff. So we got hold of him and cracked him with a few good horror show toll chocks, but he still went on singing. The song went, "And I will go back to my darling, when you, my darling, are gone." But when Dim fisted him a few times on his filthy drunkard's rot, he shut up singing and started to creech, "Go on, do me in, you bastard cowards. I don't want to live anyway, not in a stinking world like this one." I told Dim to lay off a bit then, because it used to interest me sometimes to slushy what some of these starry decreps had to say about life and the world. I said, "Oh, and what's stinking about it?" He cried out, "It's a stinking world because it lets the young get on to the old like you done, and there's no law nor order no more." He was creeching out loud and waving his rookers and making real horror show with the slovos, only the odd blurp blurp coming from his quishkas like something was orbiting within, or like some very rude interrupting sort of a mooge making a shoom. So that this old vet K kept sort of threatening it with his fists, shouting, "It's no world for an old man any longer, and that means that I'm not one bit scared of you, my boyos, because I'm too drunk to feel the pain. If you hit me and if you kill me, I'll be glad to be dead." We smacked and then grinned but said nothing. And then he said, "What sort of a world is it at all? Men on the moon and men spinning round the earth like it might be midges round a lamp. And there's not no attention paid to earthly law nor order no more. So your worst you may do, you filthy, cowardly hooligans." Then he gave us some lip music, like we'd done to those young Millicents, and then he started singing again. "Oh, dear, dear land, I fought for thee and brought thee peace and victory." So we cracked into him lovely, grinning all over our litsos, but he still went on singing. Then we tripped him, so he laid down flat and heavy and a bucket load of beer vomit came whooshing out. That was disgusting, so we gave him the boot, one go each, and then it was blood, not song or vomit, that came out of his filthy old rot. Then we went on our way. It was round by the old municipal power plant that we came across Billy Boy and his five droogs. Now, in those days, my brothers, the teaming up was mostly by fours or fives, these being like auto teams, four being a comfy number for an auto and six being the outside limit for gang size. Sometimes gangs would gang up so as to make like Malenki armies for a big night war, but mostly it was best to roam in these like small numbers. Billy Boy was something that made me want to sick just to vidy his fat grinning litso. And he always had this von of very stale oil that's been used for frying over and over, even when he was dressed in his best platties, like now. They vidied us just as we vidied them. And there was like a very quiet kind of watching each other now. This would be real. This would be proper. This would be the Noz, the Uzi, the Britva, not just fisties and boots. Billy Boy and his droogs stopped what they were doing, which was just getting ready to perform something on a weepy young Dvotchka they had there, not more than 10, she creeching away but with her platties still on, Billy Boy holding her by one rooker and his number one Leo holding the other. They'd probably just been doing the dirty Slovo part of the act before getting down to a Malenki bit of ultra-violence. When they vidded us a-coming, they let go of this boo-hooing little Petitsa, there being plenty more where she came from, and she ran, with her thin white legs flashing through the dark, still going, "Oh, oh, oh," I said, smiling very wide and droogy, "Well, if it isn't fat, stinking Billy Goat, Billy Boy in poison, how art thou, thou globby bottle of cheap, stinking chip oil? Come and get one in the yarbles, if you have any yarbles, you eunuch jelly thou." And then we started. There were four of us to six of them, like I have already indicated, but poor old Dim, for all his dimness, was worth three of the others in sheer madness and dirty fighting. Dim had a real horror show length of Uzi or chain round his waist, twice wound round, and he unwound this and began to swing it beautiful in the eyes or glazies. Pete and Georgie had good sharp noses, but I, for my own part, had a fine, starry horror show cutthroat Brit for which, at that time, I could flash and shine artistic. So there we were, dratsing away in the dark, the old Luna with men on it just coming up, the stars stabbing away as it might be knives, anxious to join in the dratsing. With my Britva, I managed to slip right down the front of one of Billy Boy's droog's platties, very, very neat, and not even touching the plot under the cloth. Then, in the dratzing, this droog of Billy Boy's suddenly found himself all opened up like a pea pod, with his belly bare and his poor old yarbles showing, and then he got very, very raz-traz, waving and screaming and losing his guard and letting in old Dim with his chain snaking, whoosh, so that old Dim chained him right in the glazies, and this droog of Billy Boy's went tottering off and howling his heart out. We were doing very horror show, and soon we had Billy Boy's number one down underfoot, blinded with old Dim's chain, and crawling and howling about like an animal, but with one fair boot on the Gulliver, he was out and out and out. Of the four of us, Dim, as usual, came out the worst in point of looks. That is to say, his litso was all bloodied and his platties a dirty mess, but the others of us were still cool and whole. It was stinking, fatty Billy Boy I wanted now. And there I was, dancing about with my Britva like I might be a barber on board a ship on a very rough sea, trying to get in at him with a fair few slashes on his unclean, oily litso. Billy Boy had a noz, a long flick type, but he was a malenky bit too slow and heavy in his movements to vred anyone really bad. And, my brothers, it was real satisfaction to me to waltz left 2-3, right 2-3, and carve left cheeky and right cheeky so that, like, two curtains of blood seemed to pour out at the same time, one on either side of his fat, filthy, oily snout in the winter starlight. Down this blood poured in, like, red curtains, but you could viddy Billy Boy felt not a thing, and he went lumbering on like a filthy, fatty bear poking at me with his noz. Then we slooshied the sirens and knew the militants were coming with pushkas pushing out of the police auto windows at the ready. That little weepied Vochka had told them, no doubt, there being a box for calling the Rozzes not too far behind the Muni power plant. "Get you soon, fear not," I called, stinking Billy Goat. "I'll have your yarbles off, lovely." Then off they ran, slow and panting, except for number one Leo out snoring on the ground, away north towards the river, and we went the other way. Just round the next turning was an alley, dark and empty and open at both ends, and we rested there, panting fast, then slower, then breathing like normal. It was like resting between the feet of two terrific and very enormous mountains, these being the flat blocks, and in the windows of all the flats, you could viddy like blue dancing light. This would be the telly. Tonight was what they called a world cast, meaning that the same programme was being viddied by everyone in the world that wanted to, that being mostly the middle-aged, middle-class ludies. There would be some big famous stupid comic Chelovic or black singer, and it was all being bounced off the special telly-satellites in outer space, my brothers. We waited, panting, and we could slooshy the sirening militants going east, so we knew we were all right now. But poor old Dim kept looking up at the stars and planets and the Luna with his rot wide open like a kid who'd never vidded any such thing before, and he said, "What's on them, I wonder? What would be up there on things like that?" I nudged him hard, saying, "Come, gloopy bastard as thou art, think thou not on them. There'll be life, like down here, most likely, with some getting knifed and some others doing the knifing. And now, with the notchy still Molodoy, let us be on our way, oh my brothers." The others smacked at this, but poor old Dim looked at me, serious, then up again at the stars and the Luna. So we went on our way down the alley, with the world cast blueing on either side. What we needed now was an auto, so we turned left coming out of the alley, knowing right away we were in Priestly Place as soon as we vidded the big bronze statue of some starry poet with an apy upper lip and a pipe stuck in a droopy old rot. Going north, we came to the filthy old Filmdrome, peeling and dropping to bits through nobody going there much except malchicks like me and my droogs, and then only for a yell or a razz-rez or a bit of in-out in the dark. We could vidy from the poster on the Filmdrome's face a couple of fly-dirted spots trained on it, that there was the usual cowboy riot, with the archangels on the side of the US Marshal six-shooting at the rustlers out of Hell's Fighting Legions, the kind of hound and horny vesh put out by State Film in those days. The autos parked by the cine weren't all that horror show, crappy starry veshes most of them, but there was a newish Durango 95 that I thought might do. Georgie had one of these polyclefs, as they call them, on his keyring, so we were soon aboard. Dim and Pete at the back, puffing away lordly on their cancers, and I turned on the ignition and started her up, and she grumbled away real horror show, a nice warm vibratey feeling grumbling all through your gutty wuts. Then I made with the Noga, and we backed out lovely, and nobody vidded us take off. We fillied round what was called the back town for a bit, scaring old Vex and Chinas that were crossing the roads and zigzagging after cats and that. Then we took the road west. There wasn't much traffic about, so I kept pushing the old Noga through the floorboards near, and the Durango 95 ate up the road like spaghetti. Soon it was winter trees and dark, my brothers, with a country dark, and at one place I ran over something big with a snarling toothy rot in the headlamps, then it screamed and squelched under, and old Dim at the back near laughed his Gulliver off, ho, 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 at that. Then we saw one young Malchick with his sharp, lubby-lubbing under a tree, so we stopped and cheered at them. Then we bashed into them both with a couple of half-hearted tolchocks, making them cry, and on we went. What we were after now was the old surprise visit. That was a real kick and good for smecks and lashings of the ultra-violent. We came at last to a sort of village, and just outside this village was a small sort of a cottage on its own with a bit of a garden. The Luna was well up now, and we could vidy this cottage fine and clear as I eased up and put the brake on, the other three giggling like Bazoomney, and we could vidy the name on the gate of this cottage fesh was Home, a gloopy sort of a name. I got out of the auto, ordering my droogs to shush their giggles and act like serious, and I opened this malenki gate and walked up to the front door. I knocked, nice and gentle, and nobody came. So I knocked a bit more, and this time I could slushy somebody coming, then a bolt drawn, then the door inched open an inch or so, then I could vidy this one glass looking out at me, and the door was on a chain. Yes? Who is it? It was a sharps galos, a youngish devotchka by her sound, so I said, in a very refined manner of speech, a real gentleman's galos, "Pardon, madam, most sorry to disturb you, but my friend and me were out for a walk, and my friend has taken bad all of a sudden with a very troublesome turn, and he is out there on the road, dead out and groaning. Would you have the goodness to let me use your telephone to telephone for an ambulance?" "We haven't a telephone," said this devotchka. "I'm sorry, but we haven't. You'll have to go somewhere else." From inside this malenki cottage, I could slushy the clack, clack, clacky, clack, clack, clackety, clack, clack of some vec typing away, and then the typing stopped, and there was this Chelovic's coloss calling, "What is it, dear?" "Well," I said, "could you, of your goodness, please let him have a cup of water? It's like a faint, you see. It seems as though he's passed out in a sort of fainting fit." The devotchka sort of hesitated and then said, "Wait." Then she went off, and my three droogs had got out of the auto quiet and crept up horror show stealthy, putting their maskies on now. Then I put mine on. Then it was only a matter of me putting in the old rooker and undoing the chain, me having softened up this Devotchka with my gent's galos, so that she hadn't shut the door like she should have done, us being strangers of the night. The four of us then went roaring in, old Dim playing the chute as usual with his jumping up and down and singing out dirty slovos, and it was a nice Malenki cottage, I'll say that. We all went smacking into the room with a light on, and there was this Devotchka sort of cowering, a young pretty bit of sharp with real horror show grudies on her, and with her was this Chelovek who was her mooj, youngish too, with horned-rimmed dotchkies on him, and on the table there was a typewriter and all papers scattered everywhere, but there was only one little pile of paper like that must have been what he'd already typed. So here was another intelligent type bookman type like that we'd fiddled with some hours back, but this one was a writer, not a reader. Anyway, he said, "What is this? Who are you? How dare you enter my house without permission?" And all the time his galos was trembling and his rookers too. So I said, "Never fear. If fear thou hast in thy heart, O brother, pray banish it forthwith." Then Georgie and Pete went out to find the kitchen, while old Dim waited for orders, standing next to me with his rot wide open. "What is this, then?" I said, picking up the pile of light typing from off of the table, and the horned-rimmed mooj said, dithering, "That's just what I want to know. What is this? What do you want? Get out at once, before I throw you out." So poor old Dim, masked like P.B. Shelley, had a good loud smack at that, roaring like some animal. "It's a book," I said. "It's a book, what you are writing." I made the old galos very coarse. "I have always had the strongest admiration for them as can write books." Then I looked at its top sheet, and there was the name, A Clockwork Orange. And I said, "That's a fair loopy title. Whoever heard of A Clockwork Orange?" Then I read a Malenki bit out loud in a sort of very high type preaching gloss. "The attempt to impose upon man, a creature of growth and capable of sweetness, to ooze juicily at the last round the bearded lips of God, to attempt to impose, I say, laws and conditions appropriate to a mechanical creation, against this I raise my sword pen." Dim made the old lip music at that, and I had to smack myself. Then I started to tear up the sheets and scatter the bits over the floor, and this writer mooj went sort of bazoomy and made for me with his zoobies clenched and showing yellow and his nails ready for me like claws. So that was old Dim's cue, and he went grinning and going, for this vexed, dithering rot. Crack, crack, first left fisty, then right, so that our dear old Droog the red vino on tap, and the same in all places, like it's put out by the same big firm, started to pour and spot the nice clean carpet and the bits of his book that I was still ripping away at, raz-raz. All this time, this Devotchka, his loving and faithful wife, just stood like froze by the fireplace, and then she started letting out little Malenki creatures like in time to the like music of old Dim's fisty work. Then Georgie and Pete came in from the kitchen, both munching away, though with their maskies on. You could do that with them on and no trouble. Georgie with like a cold leg of something in one rooker and half a loaf of kleb with a big dollop of Maslow on it in the other, and Pete with a bottle of beer frothing its gulliver off and a horror show rooker full of like plum cake. They went haw haw, videoing old Dim dancing around and fisting the writer vec so that the writer vec started to platch like his life's work was ruined, going boo-hoo-hoo with a very square bloody rot. But it was haw-haw-haw in a muffled eater's way, and you could see bits of what they were eating. I didn't like that, it being dirty and slobbery, so I said, "Drop that mounch. I gave no permission. Grab hold of this vec here so he can video and not get away." So they put down their fatty pishka on the table among all the flying paper, and they clopped over to the writer vec, whose horn-rimmed otchkies were cracked but still hanging on, with old Dim still dancing around and making ornaments shake on the mantelpiece. I swept them all off then, and they couldn't shake no more, little brothers, while he fillied with the author of A Clockwork Orange, making his litso all purple and dripping away like some very special sort of a juicy fruit. "All right, Dim," I said. "Now, for the other vesh, bog help us all." So, he did the strong man on the Dvotchka, who was still creech, creech, creeching away in very horror show four in a bar, locking her rookers from the back, while I ripped away at this and that and the other, the others going haw, haw, haw still, and real good horror show grudies they were that then exhibited their pink glassies, oh my brothers, while I untrussed and got ready for the plunge. Plunging. I could slushy cries of agony in this writer bleeding vec that Georgie and Pete held on to nearly got loose, howling bazoomny with the filthiest of Slovos that I already knew, and others he was making up. Then, after me, it was right old Dim should have his turn, which he did in a beasty, snorty, howly sort of a way with his PB Shelley masky taking no notice, while I held on to her. Then there was a changeover, Dim and me grabbing the slobbering writer vec, who was past struggling, really, only just coming out with slack sort of slovos like he was in the land in a milk plus bar, and Pete and Georgie had theirs. Then there was, like, quiet. And we were full of, like, hate. So smashed what was left to be smashed. Typewriter, lamp, chairs, and Dim. It was typical of old Dim, watered the fire out and was going to dung on the carpet, there being plenty of paper, but I said no. "Ow, ow, ow, out!" I howled. The writer vec and his Xena were not really there, bloody and torn and making noises, but they'd live. So we got into the waiting auto, and I left it to Georgie to take the wheel, me feeling that malenky bit shagged. And we went back to town, running over odd squealing things on the way.
This ends Disc 1.